File 9.
From early youth, I endeavoured to read books in the right way, and I was fortunate in having a good memory and intelligence to assist me. From that point of view, my sojourn in Vienna was particularly useful and profitable. My experiences of everyday life there were a constant stimulus to study the most diverse problems from new angles. Inasmuch as I was in a position to put theory to the test of reality, and reality to the test of theory, I was safe from the danger of pedantic theorizing on the one hand, and on the other, from being too impressed by the superficial aspects of reality. The experience of everyday life at that time determined me to make a fundamental theoretical study of the two most important questions outside of the social question. It is impossible to say when I might have started to make a thorough study of the doctrine and characteristics of Marxism, were it not for the fact that I then literally ran head foremost into the problem. What I knew of social democracy in my youth was precious little, and that little was, for the most part, wrong. The fact that it led to the struggle for universal suffrage and the secret ballot gave me an inner satisfaction, for my reason then told me that this would weaken the Habsburg regime, which I so thoroughly detested. I was convinced that even if it should sacrifice the German element, the Danubian state could not continue to exist. Even at the price of a long and slow Slavization of the Austrian Germans, the state would secure no guarantee of a really durable empire, because it was very questionable if and how far the Slavs possessed the necessary capacity for constructive politics. Therefore, I welcomed every movement that might lead towards the final disruption of that impossible state, which had decreed that it would stamp out the German character in 10 millions of people. The more this babel of tongues wrought discord and disruption, even in the Parliament, the nearer the hour approached for the dissolution of this Babylonian empire. That would mean the liberation of my German-Austrian people, and only then would it become possible for them to be reunited in the motherland. Accordingly, I had no feelings of antipathy towards the actual policy of the Social Democrats. That its avowed purpose was to raise the level of the working classes, which, in my ignorance, I then foolishly believed, was a further reason why I should speak in favour of social democracy rather than against it. But the features that contributed most to estrange me from the social democratic movement was its hostile attitude towards the struggle for the conservation of Germanism in Austria, its lamentable cocotting with the Slav comrades, who received these approaches favourably as long as any practical advantages were forthcoming, but otherwise maintained a haughty reserve, thus giving the importunate mendicants the sort of answer their behaviour deserved. And so, at the age of 17, the word Marxism was very little known to me, while I looked on social democracy and socialism as synonymous expressions. It was only the result of a sudden blow from the rough hand of fate that my eyes were opened to the nature of this unparalleled system for duping the public. Hitherto, my acquaintance with the Social Democratic Party was only that of a mere spectator at some of their mass meetings. I had not the slightest idea of the social democratic teaching or the mentality of its partisans. All of a sudden, I was brought face to face with the products of their teaching and what they called their Weltanschauung. In this way, a few months sufficed for me to learn something which under other circumstances might have necessitated decades of study, namely, that under the cloak of social virtue and love of one's neighbour, a veritable pestilence was spreading abroad, and that if this pestilence be not stamped out of the world without delay, it may eventually succeed in exterminating the human race. I first came into contact with the social democrats while working in the building trade. From the very time I started work, the situation was not very pleasant for me. My clothes were still rather decent. I was careful of my speech, and I was reserved in manner. I was so occupied with thinking of my own present lot and future possibilities that I did not take much of an interest in my immediate surroundings. I had sought work so that I shouldn't starve, and at the same time so as to be able to make further headway with my studies, though this headway might be slow. Possibly I should not have bothered to be interested in my comparisons were it not that on the third or fourth day an event occurred which forced me to take a definite stand. I was ordered to join the trades union. At that time, I knew nothing about the trades unions. I had had no opportunity of forming an opinion on their utility or inutility, as the case might be. But when I was told that I must join the union, I refused. The grounds which I gave for my refusal were simply that I knew nothing about the matter, and that anyhow I would not allow myself to be forced into anything. Probably the former reason saved me from being thrown out right away. They probably thought that within a few days I might be converted and become more docile. But if they thought that, they were profoundly mistaken. After 2 weeks, I found it utterly impossible for me to take such a step, even if I had been willing to take it at first. During those 14 days, I came to know my fellow workmen better, and no power in the world could have moved me to join an organization whose representatives had meanwhile shown themselves in a light which I found so unfavorable. During the first days, my resentment was aroused. At midday, some of my fellow workers used to adjourn to the nearest tavern, while the others remained on the building premises, and there ate their midday meal, which in most cases was a very scanty one. These were the married men. Their wives brought them the midday soup in dilapidated vessels. Towards the end of the week, there was a gradual increase in the number of those who remained to eat their midday meal on the building premises. I understood the reason for this afterwards. They now talk politics. I drank my bottle of milk and ate my morsel of bread somewhere on the outskirts, while I circumspectly studied my environment, or else fell to meditating on my own harsh lot. Yet I heard more than enough, and I often thought that some of what they said was meant for my ears, in the hope of bringing me to a decision. But all that I heard had the effect of arousing the strongest antagonism in me. Everything was disparaged. The nation, because it was held to be an invention of the capitalist class, how often I had to listen to that phrase. The fatherland, because it was held to be an instrument in the hands of the bourgeoisie, for the exploitation of the working masses, the authority of the law, because that was a means of holding down the proletariat, religion, as a means of doping the people so as to exploit them afterwards, morality, as a badge of stupid and sheepish docility. There was nothing that they did not drag into the mud. At first, I remained silent, but that could not last very long. Then I began to take part in the discussion and to reply to their statements. I had to recognize, however, that this was bound to be entirely fruitless, as long as I did not have at least a certain amount of definite information about the questions that were discussed. So I decided to consult the source from which my interlocutors claimed to have drawn their so-called wisdom. I devoured book after book, pamphlet after pamphlet. Meanwhile, we argued with one another on the building premises. From day to day, I was becoming better informed than my companions in the subjects on which they claimed to be experts. Then, a day came when the more redoubtable of my adversaries resorted to the most effective weapon they had to replace the force of reason. This was intimidation and physical force. Some of the leaders among my adversaries ordered me to leave the building site or else get flung down from the scaffolding. As I was quite alone, I could not put up any physical resistance, so I chose the first alternative and departed, richer, however, by an experience. I went away full of disgust, but at the same time so deeply moved that it was quite impossible for me to turn my back on the whole situation and think no more about it. When my anger began to calm down, the spirit of obstinacy got the upper hand, and I decided that at all costs I would get back to work again in the building trade. This decision became all the stronger a few weeks later, when my little savings had entirely run out, and hunger clutched me once again in its merciless arms. No alternative was left to me. I got work again, and had to leave it for the same reasons as before. Then I asked myself, are these men worthy of belonging to a great people? The question was profoundly disturbing, for if the answer were yes, then the struggle to defend one's nationality is no longer worth all the trouble and sacrifice we demand of our best elements, if it be in the interests of such a rabble. On the other hand, if the answer had to be, no, these men are not worthy of the nation, then our nation is poor indeed in men. During those days of mental anguish and deep meditation, I saw before my mind the ever-increasing and menacing army of people who could no longer be reckoned as belonging to their own nation. It was with quite a different feeling some days later that I gazed on the interminable ranks, four abreast, of Viennese workmen parading at a mass demonstration. I stood dumbfounded for almost 2 hours, watching that enormous human dragon, which slowly uncoiled itself there before me. When I finally left the square and wandered in the direction of my lodgings, I felt dismayed and depressed. On my way, I noticed the Arbeiter Zeitung, the workman's journal, in a tobacco shop. This was the chief press organ of the old Austrian social democracy. In a cheap café where the common people used to foregather, and where I often went to read the papers, the Arbeiter Zeitung was also displayed. But hitherto, I could not bring myself to do more than glance at the wretched thing for a couple of minutes, for its whole tone was a sort of mental vitriol to me. Under the depressing influence of the demonstration I had witnessed, some interior voice urged me to buy the paper in that tobacco shop and read it through. So I brought it home with me and spent the whole evening reading it, despite the steadily mounting rage provoked by this ceaseless outpouring of falsehoods. I now found that in the social democratic daily papers I could study the inner character of this politico-philosophic system much better than in all their theoretical literature. For there was a striking discrepancy between the two. In the literary effusions which dealt with the theory of social democracy, there was a display of high-sounding phraseology about liberty and human dignity and duty, all promulgated with an air of profound wisdom and serene prophetic assurance, a meticulously woven glitter of words to dazzle and mislead the reader. On the other hand, the daily press inculcated this new doctrine of human redemption in the most brutal fashion. No means were too base, provided they could be exploited in the campaign of slander. These journalists were real virtuosos in the art of twisting facts and presenting them in a deceptive form. The theoretical literature was intended for the simpletons of the soi-disant intellectuals, belonging to the middle and naturally the upper classes. The newspaper propaganda was intended for the masses.